to another episode of Home Field Advantage. Hope you're all having a great week or weekend, wherever and however you may be listening to us across our great country or our great land. My name is Will Highland, and it is March. Let's do the math here. March. Try that again, Will. March 10th, 2024, when I'm recording, releasing on March 11th. It's been a while. I hope you've all sprung forward and, you know, screwed around with your clocks at the government's behest. And I hope you're all plowing our way through the month of March, one of my least favorite months of the year, if not for the incredible sports calendar. We'll get to all that. I will admit it's been a while since I did an episode, had my wisdom teeth out, but don't worry, I still have all those wise sports takes. Just was in a lot of pain. Haven't been able to do a podcast. Kyle wasn't there for our last Odd Man Rush. I've been in a lot of pain, haven't been able to do a Home Field Advantage pod. So here we are. It's been a week. And then before that, I was in Florida. So been a wild month, but I appreciate you tuning in again, wherever you may be. But now that I'm back, I am going to return to doing the things I'm best at doing, which are ranting and raving about Boston sports. That said, my scope for today's episode will be pretty clear here in New England. I have a takeaway on each of the four major teams. In particular, the four professional teams. There's some college hoops, some college hockey stuff I'd love to touch on. I have an interesting take on that basketball game in New Jersey and all that. Maybe I'll save that for the end if I have time. But where I want to begin is with the New England Patriots. There will be a time and a place to talk about the NFL draft and the quarterbacks and this and that. I'm going to wait a little bit to give you my take on the quarterback situation with the rookies that are eligible to be picked, partially because there's going to be a ton of fluff and clutter analysis about these guys for the next 8 weeks. I'm just going to hold off until April and when we get closer. But if there's been one Patriots take that has dominated my reputation over the last 3 years, particularly my public sports takes, it has been my adamant defense of Mac Jones. Today, Mac Jones was traded to the Jacksonville Jaguars for a late-round pick. It marks the end of an era in New England with Mac that I think needed to end. I was a Mac believer. I was a Mac defender. I got my opinions from what I saw on the football field. From start to finish, what I saw on the football field dictated my opinions. I didn't need Felger and Mass to tell me what to think about, and I didn't need, you know, Adam Jones and Jermaine Wiggins and Greg Hill and Chris Curtis and Tommy Curran and any single Patriots voice in Boston media. I didn't want to be swayed by them, even if they agreed with me. I wanted to just focus on what I saw on the football field. That was my whole thing with Mac Jones. And I think my takes reflected that throughout his tenure in New England. First year, in, you know, leading into the season, I wanted to see him compete with Cam for the starting job. And he did that and he won. And his rookie year, I said, you know, I want to see growth and development. We saw that. The Patriots finished 10-7. He wasn't great at times, you know, but I saw him at the national stage. The spotlight didn't look too big for him. Brady's return to New England, they almost won that game. You know, but I think that was the beginning of sort of the thesis of the Mac Jones experience in New England, which was close but no cigar. He kept you in a lot of games because he was a reality quarterback. He wasn't a fantasy quarterback. What? That's something I said about Mac a lot on this program. You know, he kept you in those games, but he didn't win you those games. And as that continued to happen, and you had the 2022 season with the horrible offensive experience led by Patricia and Joe Judge, you had a lot of those situations start to come up. You know, for example, the games in Oakland, right? In Vegas. Those are two losses that, you know, the Pats were right there and Mac just didn't do enough, right? Like he was not going to lose you games in his first 2 years, but he certainly, you know, didn't really win a lot of close games, right? That was the big takeaway, is I thought, you know, that Cincinnati game in year two, right? Like, there was a lot of times where they were so close to winning, and it was something that was out of Mac's control. Like, even his first career start in New England was a fumble by Damian Harris deep in the Dolphins' territory. They lost that game. If you go back, you look, you think about all those games that New England lost that were so close. Like, even last year, the Philly game, the Miami game, the Washington game. Those were all situations where, you know, Mac didn't put you in a position really to lose the game, but he didn't really win the game when he had the opportunity. Now, unfortunately, what started to happen on the field is after the Patricia and Judge season, when there were a lot of public outbursts and it was clear that the team didn't really believe in him, they didn't change course in 2023. And it was clear that Mac wasn't the same guy. And what started to happen is he started to put you in positions where he was losing you games. And that's what happened against New Orleans, right? That's what happened against Indianapolis and, you know, some of those other really ugly games where you had a lot of ugly interceptions. It used to be that the Jones picks were simply 50-50 balls to, you know, Devontae Parker that didn't come down, or they were tip passes, or they were fumbles by, you know, Nelson Aguilar or something. But as time went on, it looked like Mac's confidence was completely shattered. Where that began, probably in year two, when they never really were on the same page after the injury, and you know, they were hinting around and screwing around with Bailey Zappe. You know, I think one thing that the Mac Jones experience led to was a propping up of Bailey Zappe that was comical at best. Maybe I'll get to that in a second. But ultimately, like, whether it was because of Zappe, the injury, the coaching, or whatever, Mac's confidence started to shake, and the media turned on him in a way, and the fan base turned on him in like game two or three of this year, almost as if they were looking for confirmation bias. You know, like, they didn't really like Mac in year two. Year one, they were positive about him. Year two, you know, he sort of soured them a little bit with his mood swings. And then year three, they were really looking for a reason to hate him. And it was really that New Orleans game where they flipped on Mac, and it was never the same. You know, they had him, you know, they had him in the town center, in the stocks, you know, at the guillotine, whatever historical analogy you want to use. They were, the fan base and media turned on him in an ugly way. And from that moment on, his tenure here was shattered, and it never really could recover. And so in many ways, I'm happy he was traded today. But as I've said, like, my takes on Mac Jones evolved as his play on the field evolved. He started out as a promising young quarterback who could thrive in a New England system with structure. As that structure started to disappear, so did his ability. And therefore, whether it was because of him, the coaching staff, or whatever, I would likely point out that it was a motley crew of all of those different problems that boiled over about midway through last season, and it was never going to recover. So, look, I hope he gets an opportunity to play again. It's ironic that he's going to go play with Trevor Lawrence. I think of anybody in the 2021 draft class, you can say maybe Trevor Lawrence has had more success than Mac. You know, both of them have sort of struggled to live up to their first round status. With Lawrence, it was that he made his playoff in year two, and then in year three there were huge expectations for the Jaguars and they just fell flat, you know, much like the Patriots have. So I don't know what Mac's going to do down there. He'll probably back up Trevor Lawrence. Look, Mac's from Northeast Florida, so, you know, he's going to go home in some respects. I think maybe he'll be at home there. There won't be a ton of pressure on him. I would like to think that he had something to do with this trade. I think too highly of Mayo as a guy. Mayo probably just, you know, had the big talk with him and said, look, like, you're just not in our future plans. Like, you know, we're going to trade you, and we're going to trade you to Jacksonville. I think Elliot Wolf and Mayo were probably involved in those early talks with him to get that going. And then, you know, I don't think it was something that came together in the last 2 days. And you know, then it happened. And I think he'll get another shot somewhere. There's 1 year left on his deal. He'll be a free agent next offseason. There's always teams that are looking for quarterback depth as backups. I think ultimately that's where Mac will fit in the NFL. He's not the first high-profile college quarterback to fall on his face, right? Like, of his draft class, Trey Lance and Zach Wilson were drafted 2 and 3, right? Those guys aren't going to have NFL starting jobs. At least not without a major situation going wrong. And the same will be said for Mac Jones. So it's up to Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence to carry that 2021 class. And look, Justin Fields, the Bears might even move on from him, right? So it's just a crazy situation. For that 2021 draft class. And ultimately, Mac, it's going to be written in the history books in New England as sort of a project that failed miserably. He certainly was a project quarterback in some respects. He had a high floor and a low ceiling, right? I think we saw his floor. And his floor was, he was a guy who might be able to complete some intermediate passes, couldn't do the deep ball and couldn't really handle pressure. You know, his floor was that he had to be in a perfect situation in order to thrive, and New England didn't set him up in one, so therefore he couldn't thrive. But we also saw his ceiling, right, with a good coordinator like Josh McDaniels and some decent pieces around him and some remnants of those late playoff teams in 2021. He was able to put together a good rookie campaign. I think we saw both his ceiling and his floor in New England. So it remains to be seen what another team will decide to do. Personally, I wouldn't put it past Jacksonville to, you know, start him if there was an injury to Lawrence, or start him if Lawrence struggled, just to maybe see if they could have something to work with there long-term as a backup to Trevor Lawrence. I mean, if Mac Jones's career is to be a long-term backup to Trevor Lawrence for his hometown Jacksonville Jaguars, after sort of falling into the lap of being a first-round quarterback and a national championship winner, I mean, those two might bond over that, right? Like, I think Mac wants to play, but I think Mac is sort of emotionally intelligent enough that if he can get out of New England, get a fresh start, and be the backup quarterback, you know, to a peer of his. I mean, he's no stranger to being a backup. I mean, he was a backup to Jalen Hurts and Tua at Alabama. So I think that could be a place where he could find, you know, some continuity in the NFL. So if Jacksonville keeps him as a long-term backup to Trevor Lawrence, you know, good. That's a career. That's an NFL career. But look, I get it. He's a competitor. He probably wants to play, but you should see the writing on the wall. Also, I got time, so I'm just going to throw this in there. I'm so sick of the Bailey Zappe stuff. Bailey Zappe liking the Instagram post where Mac Jones gets traded. Get out of here, dude. Like, you were, you know, the only reason you played was because Mac was bad. Like, if you were on any other team, you wouldn't have sniffed the field. He actually, in my opinion, played worse at times than Jones. Like, that last game in the snow with the Jets, I mean, granted it was the snow, but I mean, Zappe is just so bad too, right? Like, Zappe acting like he's like 1-1 over Mac Jones. Look, it's going to be, his days are numbered too, right? Like, the Patriots are not going to have Zappe be any higher than third on the depth chart heading into 2024. I just don't see it. So I think Bailey Zappe's a little petty. I thought that was a petty move. You know, it's not like it's Bledsoe and Brady here. You know what I mean? Like, Zappe didn't achieve anything, right? Like he didn't really help the Patriots. He won one game with them, you know, this year. So I think there was one game, right? Just the Pittsburgh game. I think he won more games with them in 2022. But I digress. I thought that was stupid. It's also telling that, you know, they waived Zappe in August. Nobody claimed him. And then they also, in this offseason, signed that CFL quarterback to a one-year contract. So I don't understand why they would do that. I think they see that dude as the third stringer more than they see Zappe as the third stringer. But enough talking about the third string Patriots quarterbacks. They did also re-sign Hunter Henry. I like that move. They tagged Kyle Duggar. I like that move. I think they have an opportunity to rebuild this offseason and really surprise some people. I'm not saying they're going to win the division or make the playoffs, but I think they could start a rebuild in a manner that is positive and gives Patriots fans some hope, which honestly, after the last 2 years, it's really all I ask for. All right, speaking of hope and asking for it, Red Sox, man, I'm telling you, Lucas Giolito out for the season with Tommy John surgery. Am I surprised? No, because being a Red Sox fan is in, like, since 2018 has just been one continuous gut punch. Like, they catch lightning in a bottle in 2021, and then they have a decent year, right? And then the last 2 years, they're just sort of have the same record, the same meddling team that can't win. They have a 4A pitching staff, and that's what we're running into again. Like, I like Brian Bayo. I'm glad they extended him this week. That was something good to build on. But, you know, I think they're putting way too much pressure on Brian Bayo. The dude is going to, what, pitch in his second full season in the big leagues? That's a ton of pressure to put on that kid. Right? Like, think about E-Rod. How many years we were waiting for E-Rod to break out of his shell? It took him like 4 years to really be like a solid top of the rotation pitcher. And he was aided in those years by having like Chris Sale and David Price and Rick Porcello and whatnot, like in the rotation with him. Now you've got a situation with Brian Bayo where the next best pitcher, starting pitcher, is Nick Pivetta. I mean, they're putting a ton of pressure on Brian Bayo. So that's my one critique. Also, Lucas Giolito, like, I hope the guy gets better, but, you know, you start to think about all these guys the Red Sox are paying to not pitch for them. Chris Sale traded him to Atlanta. You know, I think Chris Sale would look pretty good in this rotation right now, even with one arm, right? You know, if you can get Chris Sale off the bicycle and, you know, away from any sharp objects and TVs, then he probably would have looked pretty good in that pitching staff that's, again, going to look like a 4A rotation at best. Look, I don't blame the Red Sox for the Giolito sign. Look, they need to do it, but they need to go get Montgomery. That just needs to happen. It doesn't look – I don't think it's going to happen. I think he's going to end up, you know, back with Texas or going to go with somebody like the Yankees. I think, you know, there's all kinds of American League teams in the mix for him. It's just also weird to have Jordan Montgomery be the guy that we held out hope for. You know, there's a point in time where the Red Sox would have made a swing for someone like Nola before Dombrowski re-signed him, right? Or they would have made a swing a couple of years ago for a Scherzer or for a Verlander. You know, there's a time when the Red Sox went out and they got the best guy available at whatever position they needed most. And right now it seems like the Red Sox are shopping at, like, Marshalls and everyone else is shopping at, like, TJ Maxx. I'm sorry, not TJ Maxx. TJ Maxx is Marshalls. Macy's, right? Like, you know, when you go to Marshalls or TJ Maxx and, you know, you find something and you're like, oh, this is a really great deal. It pans out. It works. All right. That's Kike Hernandez in the 2021 playoffs. Or that's, you know, Nick Pivetta being a middle rotation guy for you. Or that's, you know, the bullpen arms last year making a difference in some of those close games. Not enough of a difference with Sox to make the playoffs, of course. But that's sort of like what you get when you go bargain bin shopping, right? You go to a place like TJ Maxx or Marshalls and you find something you like, great. But there's also like a thousand things that you don't like because, you know, they look a little cheap or, you know, they're you know, you're going to find a lot of Mac Jones jerseys at TJ Maxx, right? Great deal, but not really worth it because he doesn't play for the Pats anymore, right? So that's sort of what the Red Sox are doing, whereas other teams are finding the best and brightest available. You know, they're going to, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods to get golf clubs instead of a yard sale, right? Like that's what the Red Sox are doing. So to me, I would just point out that I'm not asking the Red Sox to be a World Series contender and spend money like they did in 2009 or 2014, 2004, 2005. Like that would be great. I would love that, but they're not going to do that. What I just want the Red Sox to do is take the Bruins and Celtics model, which I'm going to get to in a second. Take the model that won them their most recent World Series. Identify a young core, which is historically how the Red Sox have won World Series. They identify a young core. They seem to be doing that right now, which is great. They've identified that they want Bayo, they want Casas, they want maybe Sedane Rafaela or Roman Anthony or Marcelo Meyer or Kyle Teal or some of these young guys. Maybe they've identified that they want Devers to be here long term. And then they fill in the rest of the roster with ready-made major league players. Like Tyler O'Neill, fine. Okay. I would have preferred somebody else, right? Somebody with a little bit more of a big league track record. I just think about some of the guys that they brought in the past. Like think about that 2018 team. Like they bring in Eduardo Nunez. Why? Because Dustin Pedroia was hurt and Eduardo Nunez was a competent major league infielder, right? They bring in Steve Pierce. Why? Because he was good against lefties. That 2018 team, they had bullpen arms. You know, they had Craig Kimbrell, who they traded assets for, right? They had Joe Kelly, who they made a reliever. They actually realized that a guy who they wanted to be a starting pitcher was actually better as a reliever, right? They should do that with Garrett Whitlock. You know, like they were able to identify what was going to work for that ball club and fill in those guys around the Betts, the Benintendi, the Bradley core. You know, like they were able to do that. Nowadays, it seems like they are identifying this young core and then finding bargain basement guys to fill in the rest of the roster. That's not going to help them succeed. So if I were the Red Sox brass, it's too late now because we just got to roll with it. We've got Story if he's healthy. We've got Devers, right? Like I like some of their guys. You know, I think Wong's a good catcher. I think Casas is good. You know, Vaughn Grisham is hurt, so we're going to have to see how that goes at second base. I'll have a Red Sox preview out in a few weeks as we get closer, or a couple weeks as we get closer to opening day. But you know, I think they have potential to be okay, but the pitching staff is what really bothers me, is that in those years where they would build around their young core, their pitching staff was always made up of big league arms, not guys that they thought and wanted to be big league arms, but guys that were actually big league starting pitchers. 2018, they had Price, Porcello, Sale, Eduardo Rodriguez. And I believe their fifth starter that year was, oh gosh, now I'm completely blanking. Fifth starter, Eovaldi, right? Like they went out and they got Eovaldi late in the year. But earlier in the year, who was it? Could have been somebody like Brian Johnson or something like that. But anyway, like he was your five. Okay, great. Now, without Giolito, they got Bayo and Pavetta and Winkowski. Crawford. And I like Cutter Crawford, but I think they're putting a lot of pressure on Crawford and Bayo. And then I'm not really sure, right? So they have assets. You know, it's time to build your team the proper way. And I hope that changes. And I hope even if Montgomery can be your two or your three, maybe you see Bayo and Pavetta, you know, those three Cutter Crawford. I mean, like, you're looking at a decent rotation. Not great, but at least you got some big league arms in there. Wasn't long ago that we were laughing at Jordan Montgomery when he pitched for the Yankees, though. But he's changed. He's a World Series champion now. Okay. So, speaking of building teams, moving on to the other teams in Boston who are having more success than the previous two that I talked about. And I'm running short on time here, so I gotta work fast. I'll start with the Celtics. A lot of people are worried about the Celtics. They lose a game to Cleveland late. They lose a game to Denver late. A lot of people are worried about Joe Mazzulla and late game coaching. I'm going to tell you this. I am as least worried about the Celtics heading into the playoffs as I have been in the last few years. And the reason why is Porzingis and Holiday fit in handsomely here. Horford is, as a role player at this point, great for you. You know, I like some of their role players, you know, and you've got Tatum and Brown just doing their thing on a nightly basis. I think this Celtics team's going to be really hard to beat in a 7-game series. I mean, they're 7 games better than the next best team in the East. You know, I don't want to be overconfident because they've certainly blown a lot of opportunities the last several years. But outside of, you know, something going incredibly wrong, I like the Celtics team to make the NBA Finals. Now, what happens when they get there, we'll have to see. But I think the Celtics team could do some real damage in the playoffs. I just think they're going to be incredibly hard to beat over a 7-game series. You know, I think if they get the kind of bench contributions that they've gotten, you know, guys like Pritchard and whatnot, it will be very, very difficult to beat the Celtics, especially on home with home court, in a 7-game series 4 times. You know, it's just, you know, I don't think it could still happen. Look, like a Miami could spring up there again, or, you know, they might run into a team out west in the finals. It's better than them, you know, Denver, right? We saw that last week. But I would just point out, there's a lot of people screaming about the Celtics right now. They're going to be really good in the playoffs. I just feel it. So I'm speaking that out to all of you Celtics fans who need to be talked off a ledge by somebody who's pretty neutral about basketball. All right, moving on. Bruins. They made some moves this week, too. They bring in Pat Maroon, Andrew Peak. All right, they deal off Jacob Zaboral and some picks and another guy I've never heard of. But here's my take on the Bruins. All right. They are a model of this is how you build a hockey team. And we're going to talk more about this with Kyle when we finally do an odd man rush on Thursday. I know you've been hearing that, but we are doing it this Thursday. We're going to recap the trade deadline and everything. So I'll dive deeper in the Bruins then. But my overall thesis is this. Think about the Bruins for the last 10, 15 years. Have they ever rebuilt? No, they haven't. They might be the only team in the NHL that hasn't had to rebuild. Maybe Tampa Bay hasn't had to rebuild. I don't really think Dallas has really had to rebuild that much, or maybe the Kings or somebody like that, but the Penguins look like they're getting there. But the Bruins haven't had to rebuild. You might ask why, and the reason why is everyone's talking about the Vegas Golden Knights model. That's been the Bruins model, all right? You identify a group of players, usually between the ages of 25 and 30. You build around those players for 7 to 8 years. Then those guys age, and by the time those guys age, you have another 25 to 30-year-old group, right? So with this Bruins example, it began with you had Bergeron, Krejci, Marchand, Rask, Chara-ish. He was a little bit older. Then you had Lucic, and that was your core. All right, you identified this is who we're building around. This is like, say, 2007, 2008, 2009. All right, then you win your cup in 2011 with complimentary pieces that you bring in, like Rich Peverly and Dennis Seidenberg and whatnot, and you have Johnny Boychuk, and you have some like other veterans who had been around. Like Boychuk, I think, had played for other teams and done well. Ferentz had played for the Flames and gone to Stanley Cup. So you had had like guys who had, Mark Recchi had been around. So that's how you win. They won their 11 Cup, and largely that's how they went to 2013 when they had Horton, right? They had, but they had young guys too. They had Tyler Seguin. But what they did is between 2013 and 2017, they took pieces of that core that were no longer part of their future plans, like Dougie Hamilton, Milan Lucic, Tyler Seguin. They traded those guys. They accumulated some picks. Meanwhile, they were still good during that time period. They won a President's Trophy in 2014. They had a little bit of a step back, 2015, 2016, but they retooled on the fly. They packaged those picks. Then you end up drafting Charlie McAvoy, David Pastrnak, and Brandon Carlo, and you build this secondary core that has now sort of displaced the first core. You know, Marchand is really the only one left from that first core now that Krejci has retired, and Bergeron has retired, and Chara and Rask have retired. So you have now moved on, and you have a new core with McAvoy and Pastrnak and Carlo and Charlie Coyle, who you've acquired. And that's the other piece, right? You traded all these first-round picks, and everyone's losing their mind, right? But with those first-round picks and with those other young players, like, you know, they dealt off Donato to get Charlie Coyle, who's become a part of their core. They dealt a first-round pick for Rick Nash in 2018. That would have been great. He would have finished his career probably with the Bruins. He ran into some concussion issues, so you can't really predict that kind of thing. But then they trade off picks for and players who are no longer part of their future plans, like Anders Bjork, and they get Taylor Hall, right? Taylor Hall helps you out for a few years. Then you get Hampus Lindholm with a first-round pick. Like, would you have rather in 2022 drafted a guy who's still not going to be in the NHL right now, or have Hampus Lindholm, who's a all-star caliber defenseman for you, right? And so that's what Bruins have done. The Bruins model has been, identify a core. You build around that core with veteran players, and you don't really care about your draft picks, right? Like, I'm sorry, but I don't care about draft picks in the NHL. Reason why is this. Like, you can find guys like Jeremy Swayman in the fourth round, I think, right? Like, Matt Grizzlick, I think, was a later round pick. You don't have to look, like, if you have a McDavid or a Bedard, it makes sense. But the Bruins have traded off their first-round picks, and everyone has been saying for 3 or 4 years, oh my God, they're going to pay for this. They haven't. And the reason why they haven't is because they're a free agent and trade destination, and they've built a young core already as we go forward. It's not like they're an old team. Like, everyone thinks the Bruins were old. They have guys like Pastrnak, McAvoy, Swayman, Carlo, Zacha, Hoyle. I mean, these are all part of their team going forward the next few years. DeBrusque, right? Like, they identified DeBrusque so far that they wanted him to be a part of their team. Like, I don't know after this year what he'll look like in black and gold, but you have identified players and you built around them with other complementary pieces. And because you are a free agent destination, people want to come here, you can go get James Van Riemsdyk or Kevin Shattenkirk or Morgan Geeky in the offseason and still be relevant hockey team, despite losing guys like Taylor Hall, Nick Foligno, Patrice Bergeron, and David Krejci. I wouldn't be surprised if 3 out of the 4 of those guys end up in the Hall of Fame, right? I think Bergeron's a lock for the Hall of Fame. I think you can make an argument that Krejci and Foligno could get there simply because of their longevity. Taylor Hall, we'll see. He's running some injury problems, some consistency problems. But, like, those are 3-4 really good players that you lost, plus Tyler Bertuzzi. And they replace them with what? They replace them with guys who want to come here who aren't part of their core, right? But they also elevate some young guys who with promise, like Matt Potcher or Johnny Beecher or Mason Lowry, right? So I think this idea in the NHL, like, I've saw it all week. Oh my God, picks. They're dealing off their first round pick. I'm telling you, a first-round pick in hockey means a lot if you've got an NHL-ready guy, like, and you're drafting near the top, like McDavid or Bedard or Matthews or something. But if you're an already good team with an already good core, your first-round pick's going to be what, in the 20s, 30s? You can get away with that and build around your other players with future picks, with players with cap space. It's just, people call it the Vegas Golden Knights model. Well, it's actually the Bruins have been doing it for 15 years, right? They've been a competitive team with really no rebuild for 15 years. And I don't see it happening. I don't see it happening because they're a free agent destination, they're a trade destination, they already have a young core in place. Anyway, we'll talk more hockey with Kyle on Thursday. That's going to do it for this episode, though. Let me know what you think. DM us, comment on Instagram, at Homefield Pod. What do you think of my Mac Jones takes? What do you think of my Red Sox takes? And Celtics fans, am I being too overconfident? I want to hear it all. I appreciate you tuning in, even if you're not a Boston sports fan, and hearing my perspective. It means a lot to me. As always, like I said, you can follow us on socials at Homefield Pod, and you can like, share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, both here on YouTube if you're watching, and on your audio platforms that you might be listening to as well, whether it be Spotify, Apple, Google, or Stitcher. But until next time, my name is Will Highland, and you have been listening to a brand new episode of Homefield Advantage. If you liked this podcast, please subscribe on your favorite provider, including Spotify, Apple, Google, and Stitcher. Be sure to also check us out 2 times a week on those platforms, on Monday and on Thursday. All of the Sportland USA programs are independent, and the opinions expressed in them do not reflect those of any other company, outlet, person, or entity.